I've looked at a lot of empirical data on how Bitcoin is faring through wars in Iran and the Middle East overall, and it's actually doing much, much better than what you should expect. Most people would have anticipated a drop in the Bitcoin price after what happened. And it refers to the simple fact that Bitcoin is a very agile asset if you want to move wealth fast.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledit. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Welcome back to Because of Bitcoin. We've had a very busy few weeks at Ledin, launching the world's first Bitcoin-backed loan, ABS bond, which was also the first ever product to receive an investment-grade rating by S&P. This is a transformational milestone for both Ledin and the Bitcoin industry, and we'll have a full show dedicated to this with Adam and myself. But before we do that, I wanted to bring one of my favorite and smartest macroeconomists to the show, Andreas Steno-Larsson, to discuss how all of the recent conflicts are impacting markets and what we can expect for the rest of 2026. Andreas is a renowned macroeconomist and the founder of Steno Research, now part of Real Vision. He specializes in global macroeconomic trends, inflation dynamics, and the intersection of traditional finance with crypto markets. He's the host of the Macro Mondays podcast on Real Vision, and he's a very sought-after commentator, providing very sharp insights on monetary policy, commodity cycles, and Bitcoin's role in the evolving financial landscape. He's also the founder of Nowcast IQ, a market intelligence tool used by Goldman Sachs, PIMCO, and others. And he's just a fascinating guy all around. So I'm very excited to have this conversation and to share it with you guys. So far this year, we've seen Venezuela's dictator removed, Nicolas Maduro. We've also seen US and Israeli attacks on Iran, the continued war between Russia and Ukraine, a myriad of tariffs, AI-related waves of layoffs, and we also have the upcoming midterm election in the US. All of these things have implications for markets, for Bitcoin, and today we're going to break it all down with Andreas. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Andreas Steno-Larsson. Andreas, how are you, man? Thank you for making the time. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you. We spent a few days in Miami, was it a month or two ago? And it was a couple of great days. I really sincerely appreciate the time I had to spend with you. So it's good to see you again.
Likewise, brother. Likewise. I really enjoyed it. And you're a better golfer. Obviously better than me. Absolutely. I didn't know you could golf so well. So we should go out again sometime.
Yeah, we should.
So I'm really excited to have you here. We had some really great chats in Miami. And I just wanted to bring you on the show because your views on the market I find very, very interesting. And with everything that's going on, who better to talk about, you know, where we are, where we could be going than somebody that basically dedicates their life at looking at markets. And so I guess before we get there, a question I ask everybody at the beginning of the show is, what was it like growing up in the Steno-Larsson family or household? And a question that I have, because it was very impactful for me, is, was money or finance a big topic in your family?
Yeah, it was. You know, my dad worked as a chief economist of one of the bigger banks here. So in that sense, I had macro and markets very close to me already from my upbringing. And, you know, I'm his only son. So I don't think he managed to convince my older sisters to really care about markets and macro and all of that. So I ended up being that guy. But, you know, here we are. My mom couldn't care less about markets, but my dad is pretty interested in it. He's still alive and still trading. So, you know, nowadays, we disagree on everything. So, you know, I've become my own like contrarian Steno-Larsson, if you know what I mean. I have the exact opposite views of him all the time. But back then we agreed more.
That's so funny. And it is insanely crazy to me how often the younger generation ends up emulating the parents in some form, right? I've had this happen with so many guests where you know, David Bailey's family had a magazine, you know, and so on and so forth. My dad was an entrepreneur, and, you know, so he kind of pushed me really, well, not pushed me, but encouraged me to start businesses. And so I do think that parents, if you're listening, kids are watching. I say this all the time, but, you know, educate intentionally. Okay, let's get into markets. So the first thing I wanted to kind of frame and to give some perspective to the people that are listening that may not be so familiar with your work. One of the things I like a lot about your research is you have this liquidity-centric global macro framework. And the other, you know, I think you also have a very interesting vantage point. You spend a lot of time in FX and fixed income markets. So that by its own nature has you considering and thinking different events in different parts of the world and how the different pieces of the wheel come together. Is it fair to say that you believe global liquidity is the main driver for global asset prices? And is there a way that you can summarize or distill your view into a few sentences, like the sort of meta thesis? Mm.
First of all, I think it's fair, yes. I've been a liquidity-based analyst at least for a decade, especially since the great financial crisis. That's been maybe the most important macro variable at all. And just for the information of the audience here, I think it's worth noting that several agents can create money in an economy, not just central banks. A lot of people think about central banks when we talk about liquidity, right? But central banks, they create what I call the base layer of money. They could do so by, for example, buying assets from counterparties, but also by lending through operations or term programs with their bank counterparts, all of that. But on top of that, commercial banks can also create broad money through their credit creation. So if you go to your local branch, for example, of a bank, they can create money out of thin air as long as they comply with leverage rules and what have you from the regulators. So I guess the important thing here is to watch both, like the narrow money creation from authorities, central banks and treasuries, but also the broader money creation by banks. And I especially think the latter is underappreciated as a driver, especially over the past, say, 12 to 18 months, because we've seen a lot of money created by banks, especially outside of the US, which is the first time in a long while we've seen such credit growth in Japan and the Eurozone and elsewhere. So we're seeing a lot of liquidity being created by private banks, not central banks, in this cycle. And I think a lot of people have underestimated that.
That's fascinating. And I guess just for the benefit of the audience, right? Like in the US, there, you mentioned Japan and other countries, most of these banks are creating their own local currency, right? Because they're, but at the end of the day, it all adds up to this global liquidity pile that it is, I guess, what you track. And maybe to put it into sort of the current framing, do you believe as part of that thesis that liquidity operates in cycles as like the business cycle thesis or others? If so, where do you think we are in that liquidity cycle today?
So I think it's fair to assume that there is a broad cycle related to the creation of money in the economy. Whether that cycle is exactly 4 years or 5 years is up in the air, especially now that we've seen big disruptions of the debt market, especially since COVID. And my current thesis is that this cycle is longer than usual. And I'll tell you why. Back in, say, 2020, 2021, we essentially had no interest rates on anything. Remember how COVID ended up leading all central banks to zero interest rate policies, buying of longer dated bonds, keeping long dated bonds, bond yields very low, close to zero in many cases. In Japan, it was basically zero. In the US, we got very close to, in the Eurozone, we also got very close to zero. And a lot of agents in the economy basically took note of that yield curve by ensuring that the yield curve was flat as a pancake, as the authorities did during 2020 and 2021. They basically also encouraged a lot of the debtors out there to increase the maturity of their debt profile. And that was exactly what happened in 2020 and 2021. So by prolonging the debt profile, they probably also prolonged the liquidity cycle, because the liquidity cycle is very closely correlated to the business cycle and, not least, the need to refinance debt at reasonable interest rates. And if we look at the say, average maturity, the average duration of debt compared to pre-COVID, it's probably 1 to 2 years longer on average across the globe, meaning that the liquidity cycle is probably also longer than what it was ahead of COVID. Having said that, we're probably in the last year of the cycle, might go into 2027, but it will be a close call on many of my forward-looking indicators. So my best guess is currently that will peak in this liquidity cycle somewhere around Q3 or Q4 this year, very close to the midterm
election.
Yeah, and I think that's by design to some extent as well. I've said this quite a few times last year, and I stick to that view. Scott Bessent, who's the Treasury Secretary of the US, is a master of liquidity cycles, business cycles, and all of that. He's been running money in macro hedge funds for a long while using those kind of frameworks. So I think it is by design that they're trying to get the economy to peak exactly around the midterms, because obviously when you vote while the economy is doing well, you're more inclined to vote for the guy already in office.
I've long held the view that politics drives markets and not the other way around. And my dad actually famously says that election year is when you want to be investing. So election year, like whatever you do business-wise in an election year has a very high chance of doing very well. So my dad would follow the elections calendars more so than, my dad was never a markets guy. He was just, he knew how to read the room. And he understood incentives. I think that was his thing. He's very good at understanding incentives. When you say the liquidity cycle peaks around the election, just to sort of make sure that I'm translating that to somebody that may not be as familiar with these concepts, by peaking, right? And if I'm understanding this correctly, what you're saying is the highest liquidity levels in the market are required when the debt needs to be refinanced. Mm. Is that correct?
Mm.
And so what you're saying is that at the time this debt comes due, you want to have a combination of low rates and a lot of liquidity, right? So that the everything can be re-rated or refinanced into the future. And as a lead up to that, we would have a lot of new money creation leading up into the elections with lower interest rates, with under the excuse of the war or whatever it is, and you would have basically low rates coming down, money coming in, so you can refinance the debt, and everybody's happy. Post-election, right? Is that a fair framing?
Exactly. And, you know, while we record here, obviously we have higher energy prices and all of that as a consequence of what's ongoing in the Middle East. But I don't necessarily think that it matters a whole lot for the reaction function from the central bank this year, unless it spirals out of control, of course, and that we should expect the central bank to underpin this agenda this year. That's also why they're trying to bring in their own guy, so to speak, as the new chairman of the Fed, because they want the Federal Reserve to accommodate low interest rates into this election year. And they want interest rates to be fairly low by November of 2026. And not least, they also want the yield curve to be decently steep, because that's one of the few ways you get foreigners to participate in financing the US deficit. So I think everything aligns very well with the incentive structure that you mentioned, and most, if not all, of the authorities in the US, they're on board.
So as a Bitcoiner, right, and as a moneyist, or somebody that cares about money and the impacts of money, what you're mentioning, this cocktail that you're mentioning of low interest rates and high money creation or abundant liquidity, really equals inflation, right? In many of the models, right? You throw more money into the economy, asset prices don't really, the quantity of assets doesn't really change. You're pumping in new money, you're lowering the interest rates. Really, that money should go chase assets in a steady state, and those asset prices should then move higher. Is that what you're expecting? Or how do you expect this to interplay with inflation? Because there's a few moving pieces here where you have higher commodity prices because of the war. You have, you know, the job market's under pressure due to AI. And now you have this liquidity cycle refinancing. Like, how do you think this all shakes out?
I think we'll see inflation towards the end of the year into 2027. That would be like the typical playbook given the leads and lags of the economy. And you're absolutely right. If you increase the money supply today and you assume that we have the same amount of assets and goods available in the economy in 12 months from now, or only slightly more goods available, we should obviously see inflation. And I think it's very likely that we see inflation in a year from now. Right now, one of the companies that I run is a nowcasting company. So we're, you know, looking at loads of data observations day in and day out on inflation. We actually don't see a lot of inflation outside of the spike in energy prices that we see because of the war. And I think that is a surprise to many because, you know, a lot of people I talk to still refer to the tariffs as a source of inflation. They still refer to the trade policies of Donald Trump as a source of inflation, but we actually haven't really seen it. Maybe as it's been offset by some of the other policies. And what you refer to from the job market is obviously one of those impacts on inflation. We don't see a lot of wage growth currently. We don't see a lot of housing inflation, especially not compared to the COVID period. And therefore, we have this, you know, slightly increasing inflation in goods space, but it's countered by, you know, very benign inflation trends in housing and other services, for example. So in my opinion, there is actually a decent scope for the central bank to cut interest rates, despite everything that's ongoing in the Middle East. And the inflationary impact of the war will not be particularly large in the US. It will be felt much faster in Europe and in Asia. We can already see that in the data that we track day in and day out. So I guess that is also why the US and the administration of Donald Trump is willing to let this run for a bit longer than some of his counterparts in Europe seem to be willing to.
That's fascinating. I mean, you know, as a Venezuelan, I think now, and now that I'm looking at the sort of full gamut of US military action, it does feel that the Venezuela move prior to Iran was somewhat premeditated to have sort of line of sight on some oil supply before disrupting that market as aggressively as an attack on Iran does or did. Switching gears to Bitcoin for a second, one of the things I want to pick your brain on is Bitcoin's price action recently has been pretty frustrating to some people. You're seeing pretty much every other market at all-time highs, like equities are at all-time highs, commodities are all-time highs, residential US property is at all-time highs, gold, like precious metals are at all-time highs. It really does feel like Bitcoin, and I don't want to say crypto, because crypto encompasses a bunch of stuff that shouldn't really have value, but let's just have Bitcoin for a second. It does feel like it is the only sort of dislocated market. What do you think is driving that dynamic?
So let me start by saying one thing. I think it's interesting that we've seen a pretty resilient price action in Bitcoin over this war in the Middle East so far. And I've looked at a lot of empirical data on how Bitcoin is faring through wars in Iran and the Middle East overall. And it's actually doing much, much better than what you should expect. Most people would have anticipated a drop in the Bitcoin price after what happened. And maybe it refers to the simple fact that Bitcoin is a very agile asset if you want to move wealth fast. And, you know, I've had this discussion with a load of family offices over the past days that in case you want to move wealth out of the Gulf states right now, because they're obviously in trouble with all of the drones, et cetera, coming from Iran, Bitcoin is a better vehicle to do that than a lot of other assets, right? So I just wanted to say that I think that's why we see this resilient price action, which has been a surprise to many. And, you know, having said that, I think the key discussion for Bitcoin is whether you feasibly can put it into the software bucket or not. I don't know whether you've had this discussion with other guests on the show, Mauricio,
no. But
software has had a terrible year, especially since the launch of Claude Code and all of the AI tools. You know, everyone seems to be convinced that, you know, you could just vibe code Bloomberg in 24 hours now, and hey, here we go, right? I've been very, very skeptical on software for a long time, maybe since the autumn of last year, but I'm also very skeptical that AI is able to disrupt, you know, very vertically integrated software. I include Bitcoin in that basket. And let me try and mention why. You know, sure, you could argue that Bitcoin, or maybe it's clearer with Ethereum or Solana, is some kind of a software as a service, right? You pay a fee to use the code every time you transact. That's fair. But you tend to forget the exceptional layer of infrastructure needed to run this. which is not the case for a lot of other software outlets, right? For Bitcoin, you know, it's a pretty crystal clear infrastructure case to me, on top of being a software as a service. It's not something that you easily replace. And, you know, the amount of data centers and gigawatts, et cetera, going into this is something you cannot disrupt with AI. You cannot commoditize that with AI. So I think it is wrong to put Bitcoin in the software as a service bucket, even though there are some similarities. But it seems like a lot of investors have decided to do so. So in that sense, I agree with you. This is a dislocation. But I think the dislocation goes further than Bitcoin. I also think we see a dislocation in some of the, you know, best vertically integrated software players. Back to the Bloomberg example, I think it went viral a week or two ago that some guy had used Plexity AI to vibe-code Bloomberg in 24 hours. And I was that he had vibe-coded the interface of Bloomberg. And Mercer, you've probably used the Bloomberg terminal as well, right? The interface is shit. I mean, it hasn't been updated in 3 or 4 decades, right? So the interface is not really what you want to copy. You want to copy everything that's beneath the hood.
The data.
Yes, exactly. And I guess the same holds for Bitcoin, right? You could probably vibe code a blockchain. Fair enough. But you cannot vibe code the infrastructure. And the infrastructure is basically what's valuable here.
So you're saying, I think, you know, said differently, I think you're saying they're taking out the baby with the bathwater. Is that, that's how the saying goes? So basically, people are just assuming Bitcoin software and they're just selling it off, or it's in the software bucket of some portfolios that are being sold off. I actually, anecdotally, I will also share that a lot of the early Bitcoiners also come from the software world. A lot of the holders, large holders of Bitcoin, and I know this because I've spoken to thousands of clients at Ledin, and a lot of the very early adopters were guys working in the Metas and the Shopify's and the, you know, all these other companies that are now under pressure. And perhaps, you know, there's some correlation there between pressure on wages. They're not feeling as safe about their jobs. Maybe they're trying to sell off some of that Bitcoin position and save for some potentially rainy day to come. But I think I agree with your view that some of this is sort of software related more so than like macro driven, right? It's sort of Bitcoin's getting caught in the crossfire, it seems, with all these software disruptions through AI. Since we're on the topic of AI, you had a very recent post that did very well. You know, unless you've been living under a rock, most people saw that Citrini article where it was a dispatch from the future. And they're basically saying that market peaks in October of this year and it basically crashes from there because AI is basically removing all these jobs and it creates these like this negative cycle of companies invest in AI, AI replaces work, workers get laid off, companies invest that extra money back into AI and so on and so forth until there are no jobs. What was your response or rebuttal to that? And how do you think this will play out in the markets? Maybe follow on from that is Bitcoin, but I would love to sort of have you walk through that thesis.
First of all, I don't necessarily disagree that we'll peak in Q4 this year. I think that aligns pretty well with the liquidity cycle that we discussed initially, but I disagree a lot with the thesis playing out in that Citrini research paper over the next 3 or 4 years. I think, as you know, I'm a macroeconomist by background. And one of the things that we do have a lot of empirical data on, you know, dating back many decades, even centuries, is the so-called Jevons paradox. If a resource becomes more efficient, the demand for that resource will increase, not decrease. So take the example of software, which is basically the most live example of the disruption that AI will create. In 2, 3, 4 quarters, I don't even dare to think about in 2 or 3 years, the demand for software will be absolutely through the roof because it's becoming a commodity. It becomes cheaper, right? I'll give you one simple example. I spoke to my uncle the other day. He was annoyed with not being able to book his local sauna club because they had too many members compared to spots in those sauna gatherings. So I said to him, why don't we code an agent that always tracks when there is an available seat and books it for you? Since then, he hasn't missed one. That's software demand. And we were willing to pay, you know, a small fee to Anthropic to run this. And take a look at the amount of apps on Apple iOS. It's absolutely through the roof because, you know, you and I can create a new app in 2 hours with Claude Code, right? So my point is just that when software, for example, becomes cheaper, the demand becomes a lot larger, meaning that you'll probably still have jobs for a lot of people. It will just be, you know, jobs that are a lot more productive. And, you know, all of these discussions on whether white collar workers will be dead and gone in 12 months from now, it's something you hear from these AI leaders all the time, right? Dario from Anthropic and Sam Altman from OpenAI, they refer to this all the time. We'll disrupt 50% of all jobs in a year from now. I don't think that's true. If, you know, currently I refrain from using a lawyer a lot of times because I think it's too expensive. If my lawyer becomes a lot more productive, if he's able to, you know, to write a contract for me and, you know, fact check it in 15 minutes, I may be willing to pay that lawyer instead of doing it myself, if you know what I mean, because I still want that layer of expertise on top. So of course these white collar workers, they'll have to become more productive. They'll have to produce more. But if they manage to do that, then I don't see why they should lose their job, because the demand will be through the roof because it will become cheaper from a productivity adjusted perspective. So I think it's very bullish that we see these trends because, you know, the demand for everything will go up if it becomes so much cheaper.
I mean, I think that's a great counter to a lot of this idea. I think it was last week we had both the Citrini piece and a Block, Dorsey's company, laid off 40% of the staff. So it's almost like a shot chaser type of combination where people were like, oh my God, like the world's ending. This is the firing shot of a lot of the software companies. But to your point, right? Like, why? Like, I don't think that those 40% of the workforce that left Block is necessarily going to never now find a job, right? Like, they're probably going to get retooled, repurposed, and learn about AI and going into the next job, right? So that they can become more productive and keep their jobs. But it is sort of a fear that, you know, people look at some of these signposts like that Citrini piece and the layoffs from Block, and they start painting this doomsday picture of, you know, AI is coming for you and all of us. And I think you have a more optimistic view in that it's just going to make us, it's just going to release time so we can do better things, right? I hope, I mean, I'm with you. I think this type of technology, I mean, we use it a lot at Ledin. We use a lot of AI at Ledin, and it's made us incredibly more productive. The quality of, and also the thing that the team has done really well is like, when you feed the AI the right data, the right anonymized data, you empower the AI to give you better answers. So I still think that there is so much work that has to be done in these organizations to even be able to use AI for what it is. Because a lot of the work for AI is standardizing and marrying the data and consolidating the data and making it clean enough so that the AI can ingest it and then output meaningful things. And I would be hard pressed to think, I would think that 99% of the companies out there don't even have the necessary data stack that would support an AI yet. So a lot of that stuff has to be built so that it can be disrupted. But anyway, it's not an AI podcast.
Yeah. And I guess like the average user in a corporate setting, especially outside of the US, but it still holds to some extent in the US as well, will still be running the Microsoft Copilot in an offline mode, which is like running ChatGPT in 2023 or something like that, right? So there is a lot of potential still. And I don't really think that we fully understand the scope of this yet. But, you know, as an economist, I still struggle to see why it should lead to mass layoffs and permanently higher unemployment. I rather think that it leads to, you know, the most productive labor market seen ever and productivity gains that we, you know, struggle to comprehend the scope of as well. And I think it's, again, I sincerely think it's a good thing. You know, it's great that you and I and a lot of listening to this show will get cheaper access to lawyers, to tax planning, you name it, right? I mean, because those things are very expensive. I'm currently setting up a fund vehicle. I would love if my lawyers became 3x more productive setting that shit up, right? Because they're so expensive and they're probably not using AI a whole lot to set this thing up, right? So I think there is a lot of gains from this. We will pass on to, you know, various other sectors, and we'll create new jobs in the economy.
I agree with you. And here's the lawyers using AI and becoming cheaper.
Yeah. Good stuff.
one of the other things that you said, I think this was last year, but I really enjoyed, which is, this is in the context of Bitcoin pricing. And I'll get into the actual post you made in a second. But your general thesis was, when everybody expects something to happen, and the consensus view is that everybody expects the market to behave this way, it rarely behaves that way, right? And I've been of that view. And so I share that view with you. I actually start getting very worried whenever everyone I talk to gives me the same spiel about where they think the market is headed, right? Last year, we had a setup right after Bitcoin. Like early last year, we were trading over 100 and people were calling for a short drop to 70 consolidation and then going right back up to a higher high. And you went out on record and said, when everybody thinks it's going to happen, it's likely not what's going to happen, right? And it was basically, it went halfway because we did have a correction in March into the 70s, but we never rallied into the higher highs. And so as I was preparing for this show, I was looking around before today's rally. Right now we're at 74, right? Like as of last night, we were at 68. And as I was preparing for this and I'm talking to people and clients and other market participants and everybody's saying, we're going lower, we're going lower, we're going lower, we're going lower. And I started getting the sense that we're not going lower, right? Because everybody's expecting us to go lower. And so I'm curious, like, where do you think the sort of, I'll give you my two cents. I thought going into this, as of up until today, everybody was saying, we're going to test 50, we're going to test 50, and then we're going higher. It seems like we're going to bounce back from the 60s and rally back up. But what do you feel about, how do you feel about the current setup? And, you know, how pro or against are you towards the view that we're going higher?
So let me start with a piece of anecdotal evidence. That's always a good thing, right? So, you know, I've written a book on my long-term Bitcoin thesis in Danish, so I'm not even trying to sell it to the audience here. Most of you will not get a word of it. But I published that book, I think, in late 2024 with long-term view that Bitcoin would go to $1 million in 2030. I think I wrote that around that date, right? And obviously, a couple of decent journalists called me, asked me, okay, how do you feel about that thesis right now? And they've called me this year, right? And I've participated in a couple of TV shows being asked about that same thesis. And I've been like, yeah, I'm probably not that enthusiastic right now. Even I didn't even dare to try and pitch my idea from the book because the sentiment was so bad, right? And I think it's very telling. You know, even the biggest advocates, they currently struggle to find the enthusiasm to say what they said a year ago. It's incredibly telling. I also think it's incredibly telling what we've seen over the past week, where, again, quality software names and Bitcoin are up more than everything else in this slight rebound that we've seen after the beginning of the war. It tells you something about the positioning, right? Everyone's out of the trade. The sticky money in Bitcoin are actually, they're found in the ETF this time around, which is very interesting, the IBITs, for example, right? I think there's a year-to-date inflow to the ETF this year, despite the price action seen, which is quite amazing, right? So as someone wrote on X today, you got to thank your parents and their pension schemes, right? Because they're the ones behind this year, and they're the ones keeping the price action intact because all of the early adopters have been, you know, selling. I think that's been pretty clear, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that sentiment couldn't be much worse than it is right now, which is a good accumulation point. You can prove that. Whether that means that we'll go higher in a month or two, always up in the air. Jury's out on that. But I wouldn't mind adding to my Bitcoin position here. And I've actually written on Friday that I am now slowly but surely trying to lean into it. So I'm daring to, you know, I'm finally daring to try and, you know, pitch the idea that it will rebound again. And that's, you know, having said that, you know, if the typical four-year cycle plays out, I obviously shouldn't buy yet. Then we should wait until the end of this year or something like that, right? But I've never been a fan of that four-year. It's still theory in my view. I mean, it's obviously been empirically true, but it could be a coincidence, right? And I still think it is a coincidence.
But it's not a Bitcoin cycle. It is a liquidity cycle, a presidential election cycle. It just happens to be a halving cycle. I actually think Satoshi planned it that the halving happened on election year. I don't think it's a coincidence. I actually think it's very much the case. And I think Lynn Alden makes this point all the time. It's like, it's the halving just happens to be overlaid on top of the global liquidity cycle and the election cycle. And it's, whether it's a coincidence or not, we don't know, but we can't sort of pin Bitcoin's behavior to just the halving, right? Like it doesn't happen in a vacuum. I'm looking at a few catalysts this year for price action. One of the things I'm watching is the sort of, you know, the progress or outcome in the Clarity Act, also the midterms. Are there any other events like that that you're paying attention to or think will have a sort of disproportionate impact on the price?
The Clarity Act is of course incredibly important. On top of that, it's difficult to pinpoint one date, exact date for that trend, but I'm really watching the adoption pace of stablecoins here because it will have like broad positive ramifications for the overall sector, including Bitcoin, especially since, you know, the adoption of agents within the AI space will probably lead to a whole new economy with a lot of microtransactions and all of that, which the old fiat system is not really well equipped to deal with. And back to the example I gave with this sauna club booking agent that we created for my uncle, right? That kind of agent will likely end up transacting via some sort of microtransaction set up via stable coins with counterparts at some point. The pace of adoption there will be incredibly relevant for the space and also for the overall, you know, feasible fee structure of chains going forward. I'm a pretty fundamental guy in the sense that I like to sit down and create a valuation sheet. And I even do that for chains, right? Even though some people call me crazy when I do that. But I've fiercely defended the valuation of everything from Bitcoin to Ethereum to Solana based on what you should expect from future fees. Because if we move towards an agentic economy where we microtransact on these chains day in and day out, I don't think it's out of the world to, you know, think of fees that are 100x what they are right now. I think it's manageable to get there if we move the transactions from the fiat system to the agentic microtransaction chain system. We're not getting there this year, but you know, as soon as we get, because that's kind of the positive story for Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana from AI. We're only hearing the negative story right now, but as soon as people start to acknowledge this, as soon as we start to see some agents transacting via stable coins, etc., I think it will turn out to be a very self-fulfilling and positive narrative. So that's, I'm kind of waiting for that narrative to show up sometime this year, and I think it will.
That's fascinating. I mean, not to get into sort of fee dynamics, but one of the challenges I have with this idea that there's a moat or there's defensibility on those on-chain fees is the fact that most of these agents are going to be chain agnostic, right? And, you know, why would you choose Solana over Tron or Tron over Cardano? Because I think there's this idea that the chains have a network effect. But if you look at the network effect itself, network effect comes from the interconnectedness of nodes, right? Different nodes on the network. So what are the endpoints of the nodes? I actually think the endpoints of the nodes are the wallets. And the wallets are all blockchain agnostic for everything. And so there is a network effect, but it's on the wallets, not the chain, right? And so there's always going to be this like fierce race to the bottom on fees. I don't know. I'm
sure
this is the...
But that is why, and we had this discussion on inflation, right? I actually think that most chains will survive even in a deflationary world because they're kind of built to meet that, if you know what I mean. They'll have to be able to cope with a race to the bottom. Is it an issue for, again, just taking one example, is it an issue for Solana if the fee is $0.00001 per transaction? It's not. I don't think it is an issue.
And it's fascinating you said that because I was just having a conversation earlier this morning with this concept that tokens never die. Because in a company, you go bankrupt, right? You can't pay your registration. Like you have these costs to exist, right? But a blockchain could presumably just keep minting coins and paying out rewards, like increasingly dilutive rewards. It's like, you know, those math calculations that never get to zero. They just get closer and closer, but never get to zero. I feel like it's almost like that. But listen, I'm watching it very closely. I do think there's tremendous value in stable coins, and these stable coins need chains to transact in. There will be an economy around it. It's just, for me, it's just still a little hard to see how the dynamics play out. And you follow probably that world much closer than I do. So,
yep. And I guess by the end of the day, Marisha, which is very difficult to imagine right now, it depends on, you know, the velocity of transactions. And maybe the velocity of transactions will absolutely explode as a consequence of agents, right? Which means that I think currently stable coins host transactions just south of like $10 trillion a year or something like that. But could that be 1,000x that? I mean, if we microtransact with each other all the time, then it's okay if the fee is 0.01, right? Yeah. So let's see. And I mean, it's difficult to imagine the scope of this. Again, this is like kind of the second derivative of AI in a sense in the world of crypto. And yeah.
I'm getting so many ideas as I'm talking to you about this whole AI stuff, because I think one of the other things that would be interesting from an agent's perspective is this idea of settlement, final transaction, like transaction settlement in real time, and not have to wait and your credit card could bounce it back. Like agents can't allow that. They need to operate fast, right? And so they won't allow these clawback periods or whatever it is. They'll go for the stuff that doesn't have it. So I think that's also an interesting thing. I hadn't considered that until, you know, we just started chatting about this. Another one I want to ask you about, this is probably the last one. Recently, you posted, silver is not a geopolitical hedge, but oil, nat gas, and gold are. And there was another related tweet that said, so the market is buying Bitcoin and selling gold and silver today, not what pundits would have told you this morning. Can you sort of distill that comment in the current environment of sort of geopolitical volatility?
You know, I've had my fights with the silver community over the past couple of months. I actually don't have anything against silver. I just think it's a risk asset. And, you know, empirically, especially over the past 6 years, you've really struggled to find any diversification effect out of having fixed income in your portfolio. I don't think that's a surprise to many by now, but it was a big surprise to a lot of people back in 2023 and 2022 when we had this inflation spike and fixed income sold off alongside equities and all of that, right? At that point, I kind of figured out that I had to have some energy in my portfolio as my bond position. It's kind of the only thing that really works if we start throwing rockets at each other in the Middle East, right? And the Strait of Hormuz is closed and all of that. Especially nat gas is incredibly sensitive to such events, but oil is obviously as well. And, you know, the past week has been one big victory lap for that view, right? You've had great returns within nat gas and oil, while everything else, maybe ex-Bitcoin, has been flatlining at best. And I think the reason why they serve as geopolitical hedges is that, you know, energy is everything. Energy is also Bitcoin, right? Without energy, you don't have Bitcoin. So it is a necessity. It's also a necessity for food, right? I mean, you cannot have food without fertilizers and nat gas, right? So that's why it is the ultimate hedge. Gold is a very decent hedge because central banks find it valuable to hold. And increasingly so since COVID, especially so after the Russian invasion of Ukraine and after the seizure of the Russian frozen assets, right? So I think that's why not a lot of central banks find value in holding silver. I think we have a handful of central banks buying, but it's not really a lot. They found a lot of value in holding silver a few centuries ago, but I think it's more likely that they'll end up with a combination of gold and Bitcoin. They're also very, very early in adopting Bitcoin, but we could get there.
I mean, man, I could keep going for another hour because I find, you know, your views so interesting. I would love to pick your brain on the recent Dalio comments on like central banks will never buy Bitcoin. I haven't fully digested his arguments, but I think it goes along the lines of they won't buy it because you'll have to show your cards and tell the world you hold it, which I think, you know, Dave, another person I was in another show this morning was saying that perhaps not the sort of Chinese central bank or the US central bank. Like they don't want to show you their hands. That's why they haven't revalued Fort Knox and all that stuff. But a lot of the hungrier banks, the guys that are trying to demonstrate transparency to the world and bring over and capture some of that money reserves, like they will. But yeah, anyway, you said central banks would end up with a combination, so I thought I'd pick your brain on it.
I'll say this. I think you're right that a couple of the very big central banks will probably decide not to. But in the case of the People's Bank of China, I've been to their head office quite a few times. I've served them as a sell-side economist for years. By the way, like their transparency when you visit them. So I don't think they're that intransparent. But they've obviously tried a couple of times saying to the market, hey, we're not buying gold at the moment. And then you look at the customs data. And I mean, they don't mine the gold in China, right? So we do have customs data showing that gold is moving to China, right? From our end. So you can call out the bullshit when they're trying to be intransparent, right? So I don't necessarily think it's a good view. Or I mean, even for gold, they cannot hide it. So why does that make it a lot better than Bitcoin from that perspective? I don't think so.
I this reminds me of a quote my grandfather used to say, which I loved. He says, there's two things in the world that you will never be able to hide. A cold and money. So he was before Bitcoin. But yeah. Anyway, listen, man, thank you so much for your time. We'll have to do this again, hopefully in a few months or something. Where can people listening learn more about your research? I know you're a Real Vision, but please tell us everything around how they can find you and read your research.
Yeah, so I'm very active on the X app at Andreas Steno. Then I run a cross-asset macro portfolio at Real Vision. And then I have my own AI-based nowcasting company called Nowcast IQ out of London. So those are like three main channels you need to watch. And then, of course, you know, from time to time, I'll pop on podcasts like this. Thank you very much for having me, Orsio.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'll link to everything you mentioned and your research in the show notes. I look forward to seeing you again in person, man.
Thanks, brother.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion. And I think one thing I take away from it is that we can expect to see quite a bit of volatility for markets during 2026. Nobody can predict what the future holds, but if we take time to understand the incentives and potential implications from those involved and their actions, we can build a mental model or a framework that can help us understand how things could play out. It would make sense for the current US administration to try to make a push to have the economy and markets in a good spot leading up to the midterm elections. That said, there are other actors in the arena and they also have their own agendas. The other challenge is trying to predict the transformative effects of trends like AI. These things are very hard to predict, but we can safely assume that AI won't necessarily eliminate every human job out there, and instead, it'll push us all to become more productive. For us Bitcoiners, not much has changed in all of this. Governments are still spending more than they make, and they do so especially during wars. This will keep driving the value of fiat currencies lower and the value of asset prices higher. In a world where so much is unpredictable, I find a great deal of comfort knowing that every 10 minutes, we will continue to mine a new Bitcoin block. And I also love knowing that there will always be just 21 million Bitcoin. I am very excited to share the next episode with you as well, where we'll be discussing how Ledin made history by issuing the world's first Bitcoin ABS bond. This is also the first time S&P has ever given an investment grade rating to a Bitcoin product, and this deal was more than 2 times oversubscribed, confirming that there is growing understanding and pent-up demand from institutions to participate in this industry. I'll be very excited to share all of that and what this all means for the Bitcoin industry. Stay tuned. See you very soon. Thanks again, guys. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledin.io. That's ledin.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Chao, chao.